Good morning, everyone. Advent actually is my favorite season. I do love the way it begins in darkness, and with Chris misnamed that song depressing. It's mournful, but not depressing. But it moves toward the light. All right, well, as you know, first of all, I'm Catherine. I'm one of the teachers on the teaching team. For those of you at home, there are no sermon notes in the app today. I'm sorry, it was a hectic week. But just a reminder that following my message, we're going to do the Advent lighting, and then we're going to do communion. So for those of you at home, you can gather your communion elements. All right, so today is the first Sunday in Advent. And what you may not know is that in the liturgical church calendar, that makes this the first day of the church year, which means it's Happy New Year in the church year. So yes, the church year begins on the first Sunday of Advent. And you're probably wondering, why? Why not begin the church year on Christmas Day with the birth of the baby Jesus? Or maybe on Easter Sunday with the resurrection? Or maybe on Pentecost when the Holy Spirit kickstarts the church? Nope. The new year begins in darkness, in the shadows, because that is where God's grace arrives, and that is where God's love is most visible. And that is where we as a church are called to light candles of hope, peace, joy, and love to push back against the darkness, to light candles against the shadows. Advent begins in darkness and moves into light, toward the true light. But it is easy, to ignore or overlook the significance and importance of Advent, isn't it? This time of waiting and hoping and longing and anticipation and preparation for what God is doing, walking the earth as one of us. It's easy to overlook Advent because we've been trained or conditioned or at least encouraged to respond to a more secular and feel-good kind of Christmas, filled with sentiment and nostalgia, while simultaneously being groomed to be consumers because we're being bombarded with messages that say getting or giving a car or diamonds or the must-have toy is the way to have the most meaningful Christmas. But we know this, don't we? We know we're being groomed this way. And so every year we vow this year it's going to be different. I'll be more conscientious about my budget. I won't overspend. I'm going to give gifts of time instead of stuff. I'm going to be more conscientious about the environment. I won't buy plastic ribbons or plastic ornaments. What's better, a fake tree or a live tree? Is it even a present if I don't cover it in wrapping paper? Well, the theme of our Advent season is called Deconstructing Christmas. And my message today is, what does it mean to be blessed? And as I was working on this message, I realized that I've been deconstructing and reconstructing Christmas my whole life. And you probably have too, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not, sometimes reluctantly. But maybe like me, possibly always an adventure in missing the point. And I'm going to share a little bit of what that's been like for me. We were in Arizona for the last 4 days, and I thought it was dry here during the Santa Anas, but it is so dry there. I have wonderful childhood Christmas memories. My heritage is German and Norwegian, and at Christmas time, that kicked into overdrive, especially the German side. We ate traditional German and Scandinavian food. Maybe you'll recognize some of these words: lefse, pfeffernuss, pickled herring, lutefisk, sauerkraut, pot roast, beets, all kinds of vegetables and cream sauce. My grandmothers could cook any vegetable in cream sauce and call it good for you. And then cookies. The German side is just huge on cookies. And all of this was possible because my grandparents arrived from the Midwest every Christmas time for about a month, and they were in the kitchen nonstop. Kitchen and church are the two places I associate with Christmas. And in the German tradition, Christmas Eve is way more important than Christmas Day. Santa comes on Christmas Day, but Jesus shows up on Christmas Eve. And so when growing up, I thought that's how Christmas should be. Well, then as a young mom with my grandmother's gone, I couldn't replicate my own childhood Christmas for my children. But I also looked at my childhood Christmas from a different perspective now as a grown-up. And I wondered, how did my own parents feel about the upheaval in their lives every Christmas when the grandparents arrived? It must have been stressful. All of us sharing bedrooms and bathrooms, my mom hiding the ashtrays and giving up smoking for a month so her mom wouldn't know that my mom smoked. How did my dad feel about my grandpa who could fix anything? And he found everything in the house that had been broken during the last year and fixed it. Made my dad probably feel kind of bad. But then Tom and I were starting our own family, and I was learning about how to do Christmas from my church, and this would have been in the 80s. And from my Christian friends at this church, I learned some rules about Christmas that I hadn't realized were important. Things like, it's much better to listen to and sing Christmas hymns than it is to listen to secular Christian songs like Santa Claus is Coming to Town or I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Under the Christmas Tree. And the Christmas card you sent, and we actually sent cards in the mail in those days with stamps, your Christmas card had to feature the Holy Family, Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus. Not a snow scene, no Santas, nothing secular. And you had to actually make sure that the postage stamp you used was the Christmas religious postage stamp, not the Christmas snow scene. Oh my gosh, there were so many rules. I can't believe it. Okay, and when decorating your house, a nativity had to be featured. It had to be the focal point. Like when you walked in, you could see the nativity scene, you know, the creche with the baby Jesus and Mary and Joseph. And so it seemed like the best place for Santa and the elves, if you dared to use them, would be the bathroom or the garage. And you could never say Merry Christmas, because we were all about keeping Christ in Christmas. And by the way, you should also be featuring that as the bumper sticker on your car, keeping Christ in Christmas. So in the 80s and the 90s, I also worked in retail full-time. I was a department manager for, they're extinct now, but the Robinson's department store. So Christmas in retail is really fun. There's nothing like watching people just like yourself lose all common sense and human decency in the pursuit of the perfect Christmas gift. Or to be told as you're walking out the door on Christmas Eve that the competitor in the same mall has just marked down the designer sportswear so that it'll be on sale the day after Christmas, and you have to stay and mark by hand down 1,000 pieces of designer sportswear. And there is nothing like spending hours with a customer a week before Christmas who wants to find just the right gift for someone she clearly loves, and then realizing the day after Christmas that the recipient is returning it with derogatory comments about the person who bought it. Well, from these three vignettes, possibly titled The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I have learned that the Christmas season and the Christmas story are two very different things. And rather than me coming up here and telling us how to conform to the Christmas season or judge it or how to change it or how to remold it, maybe we as followers of Jesus just need to re-familiarize ourselves with the Christmas story as it appears in the Bible. Because that story, it does for me, it may have for you, over the years has gotten some glitter on it, some tinsel hanging on it, some things that don't really belong there. And I think some of us are using those soft focus camera lenses to look at it that makes everything look a little blurry and maybe even a little more attractive. But before I begin deconstructing the Christmas story, I want to tell you what is a really big obstacle for all of us in understanding the Christmas story. And it's called the culture of blessing. That's what Bob Harper calls it, and I like the name. The culture of blessing is something that we are so enmeshed in We might even be perpetuating it unknowingly. It has to do with how we view our circumstances. We tend to associate God's blessing with our circumstances. When things are going good, when we feel safe and secure, when we're healthy, when there's money in the bank, the kids are all right, the marriage is steady, we might say, I feel blessed. When we get the promotion at work, or the house sells for the price we wanted, or that thingamajig we wanted to buy turns out to be on sale when we go buy it, we sometimes say, man, I feel blessed. This culture of blessing is a component of a worldview called moralistic therapeutic deism, which is a fancy name for a worldview that is defined and driven by current culture. This worldview asks very little of me while providing lots of comfort because it allows me to believe that God wants me to be happy, to have good things happen to me. It also allows me to believe that I'm blessed because I've been doing the right things in the right way, that I deserve the blessings I've received. It equates a life free from hardship as the blessed life. And lest you think nobody thinks that way, and I think we're ready for that first slide, not true. A 2021 report by George Barna stated that moralistic therapeutic deism is the most popular worldview in the United States culture today. And in her book, Blessed, The History of American Prosperity Gospel, Kate Bowler cites a Pew study indicating that 43% of all Christian respondents agreed that the faithful receive health and wealth. Wow. But now think about this. By citing our material circumstances, the home we live in, the food on our table, the vacations we enjoy, the health and wealth of our family, the status of our bank account as evidence of our blessedness, that turns out to be a huge misunderstanding, doesn't it, of what it means to be blessed. And we're going to look at that in a minute. Because the worst thing about it is it implies that at the same time God has chosen to bless us with these gifts, he's chosen not to bless others the same way. And think about how damaging that is to someone whose life is difficult, whose marriage is falling apart, whose child is on life support. So if we want to know what it means to be blessed, we're going to have to pay attention to Jesus. And they use two Greek words in the Bible that are often translated in our Bibles as blessed. The first one is eulogemene, and basically it means good words. It's kind of what our English word benediction means, good words. It's also the same word we get eulogy from, where you say good words over someone. The other Greek word is makarioi, and this is the word that Jesus used in the Beatitudes. It's often translated as blessed or happy, but it really has a much fuller meaning. It actually means to be made full, to be filled up, to be enlarged. And so for secular Greek literature written around the same time as the Bible, it actually meant riches. So it's very interesting that Jesus chose that word for the Beatitudes. So I'm just going to read them to you today because I'm going to be referring to the Beatitudes a bit in this message. Do we have them? Yeah. This is the way they're translated in most of our Bibles. God blesses. Now that's that word. Makarioi. Sorry. The word that means filled up, enlarged, to be made full. God blesses those who realize their need for him, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. God blesses those who mourn, for they will be comforted. God blesses those who are gentle and lowly, for the whole earth will belong to them. God blesses those who hunger and thirst for justice, for they will receive it in full. God blesses those who are merciful, for they will be shown mercy. God blesses those whose hearts are pure, for they will see God. God blesses those who work for peace, for they will be called the children of God. God blesses those who are persecuted, those who live for God, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Very different from the culture of blessing, isn't it? So let's think about the Christmas story in light of the Beatitudes. Because we think of the blessing often as having to do with our circumstances, we miss what Jesus meant by blessing. And we also miss the hints and clues and intimations of blessing in the Christmas story, and therefore we miss what blessing means. So this morning we're going to look at some of the stories around Jesus' birth and see if we can discover what blessing means or what it means to be blessed. Now, most of what we know about Jesus' birth comes from the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. The people in the land were under the thumb of the Roman Empire. Taxes were high. People who did well did so by compromising with the empire. Religious leaders compromised. Business leaders compromised. But for most people, life was very difficult and very complicated. And there were factions and divisions in the political world and in the religious world. Matthew's stories of the birth of Jesus begins first with a genealogy. And then he mentions Mary very briefly. And then he tells us more than most about Joseph, the man who married Mary when she was pregnant. Matthew is the one who tells us about a star and the wise men. And he also tells us about Herod's reaction to the news that there was a newborn king of the Jews. Luke begins the story quite a bit earlier. He begins with John the Baptizer's birth, and then to the angel's visit to Mary, and then Mary's visit to her cousin Elizabeth, and then the census under the emperor, which required that trip to Bethlehem for Joseph and Mary. And it's Luke who mentions the shepherds and the angels, and the presentation of the baby Jesus in the temple, where two very aged people say something prophetic about the baby. And then Luke ends with a genealogy. Well, we tend to focus on the night of Jesus' birth, and we just pack it full of activity. Mary and Jesus wandering around Bethlehem looking for a place to stay. Shepherds in the fields, angels in the heavens, and the stars and the wise men. And that we can call the Christmas card version, because it didn't all happen on one night. Most likely, Mary and Joseph arrived in Bethlehem weeks earlier, before the birth of Jesus. And they would have expected to stay in the house of one of Joseph's relatives. But the city of Bethlehem was very full because of the census. There were no innkeepers turning away. It's just that the family houses were so full, there weren't spare rooms. So what happened is Mary and Joseph stayed in a house, but on the lower level where the families would keep the animals to come in at night. The Bible doesn't say that angels sang. And if you begin the story with, where I'm going to begin it in a minute, with the angel making an announcement to Zechariah, not Mary, we're talking probably about 3 years, because the wise men showed up probably 2 years after Jesus' birth. So I'm going to go chronologically through just a few of the stories to try to figure out what blessing really means. So it's Luke that tells us about this very old priest named Zechariah, and his equally old wife, Elizabeth. And the angel comes and tells him, Zechariah, while he's working at the temple, that he's going to have a son who will grow up with the power and spirit of Elijah, a son who is meant to come just before the coming of the Lord. And we know this son is John the Baptizer. Well, Zechariah does not respond as well as the angel had hoped. And so Zechariah's mouth is closed by the angel. He can't speak again until the baby's born. But that's a whole nother sermon, I think. But right away, Luke is giving us a clue. Because Zechariah and Elizabeth are old, Luke is connecting this story to Abraham and Sarah, another aged couple who had a son. And Luke is reminding us of the promises given to Abraham, promises of land and covenant and descendants. And Luke is telling us something is beginning to happen. What Israel has been longing for is coming true. And then Luke does a clever thing. He then goes right away to the angel visiting Mary. He's contrasting Zechariah's response to Mary's response. And this young girl handles the news far better than the mature priest does. She says yes. Yes to the angel, and she runs now to the town where Elizabeth, Zechariah's wife, lives. And Elizabeth, who is now a few months pregnant, the minute she sees Mary running to her house, she says, "You are blessed, Mary, blessed among all women, and the child you bear is blessed, and blessed I am as well, that the mother of my Lord has come to me." And those first blessed, I never fixed the slides. Those first four blessed should be in italic. That's the eulogemen Greek, the good words. But then the last blessed, "How blessed you are, Mary, for you believed what the Lord told you would be fulfilled," is the other Greek word, makarioi. You are filled, Mary. You are being full, made full. Elizabeth recognizes that God is doing something through her, Elizabeth, and also through Mary. And Mary is deeply moved by these amazing encounters, first with the angel and then with her cousin Elizabeth. And Mary's response cannot be contained in normal prose because her soul is just overflowing in song and poetry. And so she says, "My soul lifts up the Lord. My spirit celebrates God, my liberator. For though I am God's humble servant, God has noticed me now and forever. I will be considered blessed by all generations. Makarioi. I will be considered made full, enlarged with God. For the mighty one has done great things for me. Holy is God's name from generation to generation. God's loving kindness endures for those who revere him. From God's arm has accomplished mighty deeds. The proud in mind and heart God has sent away in disarray. The rulers from their high positions of power God has brought down low. And those who were humble and lowly God has elevated with dignity. The hungry God has filled with fine food. The rich God has dismissed with nothing in their hands. To Israel, God's servant, God has given help as promised to our ancestors, remembering Abraham and his descendants in mercy forever." Now, Luke is also connecting this vignette to something of the Old Testament. Miriam was Moses' sister. And our Mary in the New Testament, her name is Miriam. All these Marys running around in the Bible in the New Testament, their name is Miriam. And they're all named in honor of this woman that we're going to talk about, the sister of Moses. Miriam helped her brothers, Moses and Aaron, lead the people out of Egypt and guided them in the wilderness and brought them to the promised land. And it's Miriam who sang a very similar song of praise to what Mary just sang when the people crossed the Red Sea. People familiar with the Old Testament would know right away what Luke is trying to convey: liberation, the theme of Exodus. He wants us to hear that in Mary's song. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is blessed because she is participating in the new Exodus. God is doing something through her. And then the story in Luke moves back to Zechariah and Elizabeth. And when their baby is born, Zechariah, who's had over 9 months to rethink his response, breaks out in praise and prophecy. "The Lord has raised up a powerful sign of liberation for us from among the descendants of God's servant, King David, as was prophesied through the mouths of his holy prophets in ancient times. God will liberate us from our enemies and from the hand of our oppressors. God will show mercy to our promised ancestors, upholding the abiding covenant he made with them, remembering the original vow he swore to Abraham, from whom we are all descended. God will rescue us from the grasp of our enemies so that we may serve him without fear all of our days in holiness and justice in the presence of the Lord. And you, my son, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will be the one to prepare the way for the Lord so that the Lord's people will receive knowledge of their freedom through the forgiveness of their sins. All this will flow from the kind and compassionate mercy of our God. A new day is dawning. The sunrise from the heavens will break through our darkness, and those who huddle in night, those who sit in the shadow of death, will be able to rise and walk in the light, guided in the pathway of peace. Zechariah is singing about God's promises coming true in a very dark time for Israel under the thumb of Rome. Zechariah is seeing God's promises are coming true. Like Mary, Zechariah is connecting what's happening in the present both to the past and to the future. They are seeing that this is not about them, but about God's people and about what God is doing. Zechariah's words speak of the big story in the Hebrew Bible. It speaks of God's character and what God is doing. And from Mary's song, this poetry isn't simply recalling God's promises. She's talking about a great reversal, what might be called a social, economic, and political revolution. Everything is going to be upside down. The proud rulers brought down, the humble exalted, the hungry filled, the rich left empty. She's speaking of a king who will demote the powerful and the rich and will elevate the poor and the humble. And this means one thing: God is moving towards setting us all free. These songs are foreshadowing the Beatitudes, aren't they? Or maybe the Beatitudes are echoing these songs. And so from Zechariah and Elizabeth and Mary, we do learn what it means to be blessed. And I'm going to take a quick run through some of the other stories, because from Joseph's actions, Joseph, who was probably shamed by marrying Mary, but would have shamed her more by divorcing her, we learn that blessing happens when our responses are life-giving to others, when we're more concerned with others than with ourselves. From the story of the shepherds, we learn that God's coming is for the overlooked ones. The announcement from heaven came to the people on the margins of society. From the story of the wise men, we learn that God's coming is for all people. They're giving a picture of the time when all nations, not just Israel, are included in the covenant and worship God. And from Herod's reaction, we learn that blessing can be a threat to powerful people and to powerful institutions. I think that I'm learning that blessing is a relational word. It's about God acting, God filling, God's good words. Blessing isn't about us. It's about God acting in the world on behalf of us. And maybe just because we care so much about circumstances, because we value our circumstances above everything else, we think that God cares about them too, but not as much as we do, apparently, right? And because we think God cares about our circumstances, we often miss the blessing, the promises, the activity of God that's happening in the world all around us, because we're looking in the wrong places. Blessing is what God is doing in and around and through us to further God's plans, not ours. So this year, let's not miss the hints and the clues and the intimations of the Beatitudes in the biblical Christmas story, in this Advent season, and in the world around us. The Beatitudes highlight the great reversal of God's kingdom. It belongs to the meek, the poor, the suffering. And to be blessed is a posture. It's our orientation toward God and to others. It's seeing God at work in the world. It is awareness that the kingdom is here, it's near, and it's coming. Those words, blessing, to be blessed, to bless others, relational words. And today we looked at just a small part of how the birth of Jesus illustrates the upside-down nature of the kingdom, that God identifies with the outsider, the powerless, the ones barely getting by. I'm going to have on the screen a paraphrase of the Beatitudes. It was paraphrased by N.T. Wright, and then I really, with a lot of hubris, took the liberty of paraphrasing it even more, and I feel really weird about that. So N.T. Wright used the words the wonderful news to convey makarioi. But I think it's kind of cool because what he kind of did is he blended the other blessing word, didn't he? Eulogemen, which means good words. So he combined them and he made wonderful news. And I started to write, God fills. See, these slides are new to me. I've been flipping. It's not what I thought I did. So I'm going to read it the way I wrote it, and you can read it the way it's on the screen, and it's only one word change. Wonderful news. God fills, or God is with, the poor in spirit. The kingdom of heaven is yours. Wonderful news. God fills. God is with those who mourn. You're going to be comforted. Wonderful news. God fills. God is with the humble. You're going to inherit the earth. Wonderful news. God fills. God is with those who hunger and thirst for God's promises. You're going to be satisfied. Wonderful news. God fills. God is with those who are merciful. You'll receive God's mercy yourselves. Wonderful news. God fills. God is with the pure in heart. You will see God. Wonderful news. God fills. God is with the ones who work for peace. You will be called God's children. Wonderful news. God fills, God is with those who are persecuted because they live for God. The kingdom of heaven belongs to you. So we're doing things just a little different this morning. Have the band come up. We're going to have the Advent lighting, and then I'm going to come up and we're going to have communion, and I'll explain how that goes in a minute.